Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both the Saturday Show and the Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
Tonight on All In.
What kind of problems, Mr. President?
I think you'd have big problems.
As justice continues its pursuit of the ex-president, why no one has to imagine the big problems Donald Trump is threatening.
The caller said in part, quote, "There is a bomb on the way to the hospital. You better evacuate everybody, you sickos."
Then new reporting on the lies leading up to the Mar-a-Lago search as the Department of Justice appeals the special master ruling. And 53 days to November 8th.
I signed a letter with 120 other generals and admirals saying that Trump won the election, and damn it, I stand by my election.
Will voters buy a head-snapping Republican pivot toward democracy?
Do you stand by that today?
So, you know, we live and learn, right?
When All In starts right now. Good evening from New York. Happy Friday. I am Chris Hayes. With less than 2 months to go before the midterm elections, the Republican Party finds itself in considerably worse shape than they had expected. We've got new polling out today from the New York Times. It shows that 46% of registered voters said they would be more likely to vote for the Democratic candidate for Congress in their district if the election were held today, compared to 44% who said they would vote for the Republican. Now, that's within the margin of error. But even if we consider the parties neck and neck, a coin toss, this is not how it was supposed to go. Go back to spring, for instance, May. Republicans expected to sweep the midterm races this November, particularly with inflation raging, a Democratic president whose approval rating hovered around 38%. There's a bunch of reasons why that no longer appears to be the likely outcome. A crucial reason is a majority of this country loves and cherishes our democracy. They want to preserve the American experiment, protect self-governance. And a majority of Americans also don't like Donald Trump. That would be the man who instigated a violent coup against the democratically elected government. And yet he still retains his chokehold on the Republican Party. This is one of the central features of American politics over the last 2 years, a kind of mystery in some ways we keep coming back to. Why won't Republican politicians, now that he's out of office, throw Donald Trump overboard for their own good politically, if for no other reason? There's a bunch of answers to that question. We've gone through them here. The ex-president still rakes in a lot of fundraising dollars, for one. Many Republicans think they need him. They need Trump to excite the Trump MAGA base and turn out their voters. A whole bunch of others in the Republican Party are just genuinely true believers. They like Trump. They like Trumpism. They like the whole shtick. But there's another major factor, and it's one that always looms over Republican politics and playing into these dynamics, which is that if you cross Donald Trump and his base, you will likely find yourself in a vortex of debilitating harassment, threats of violence, and maybe even actual violence. Remember what happened to Rusty Bowers? It's the conservative pro-life speaker of the Arizona House who refused to go along with Donald Trump's coup and overturn the will of the voters in his state. He was pressured again and again and again, and he said no again and again. I cannot break my oath to the Constitution, nor my faith. He delivered incredibly compelling testimony before the January 6th committee, detailing the threats he faced and the lies spewed about him in his own community while his daughter lay dying of cancer inside his home.
We have various groups come by, and they have had video panel trucks with videos of me proclaiming me to be a pedophile and a pervert and a corrupt and politician, and blaring loudspeakers in my neighborhood and leaving literature both on my property, but arguing and threatening with neighbors and with myself. At the same time, on some of these, we had a daughter who was gravely ill, who was upset by what was happening outside.
Just one example of what can happen if you don't bend to Donald Trump's will. In this case, bend to his demand that you foment a coup, that you go along with it. And the ex-president knows this at some level. I think he does. And he regularly walks just up to the line of making explicit threats. Just yesterday, he did it again, warning conservative radio host Hugh Hewitt of what could happen if he is indicted.
I'm just asking, if there is such a prosecutor and they indict you, would that deter you from running for president again?
I don't think the people of the United States would stand for it. And as you know, if a thing like that happened, I would have no prohibition against running. You know that. You've already.
I do. And that's what I want people to understand. That would not take you out of the arena.
It would not. But I think if it happened, I think you'd have problems in this country, the likes of which perhaps we've never seen before. I don't think the people of the United States would stand for it.
What kind of problems, Mr. President?
I think they'd have big problems. Big problems. I just don't think they'd stand for it. They will not sit still and stand for this ultimate of hoaxes.
You know that the legacy media will say you're attempting to incite violence with that statement. How do you respond to what will inevitably...
That's not inciting. I'm just saying what my opinion is. I don't think the people of this country would stand for it.
There's a lot there, right? So notice how when Trump promises, quote, big problems, Hewitt understands that he is threatening violence, right? Immediately. He knows what Donald Trump is saying, even though he's not part of the legacy media. He gives Trump the opportunity to walk that back, to protect himself, right? You want to say that? The ex-president, the subject of his interview. Because, of course, everyone who listens to that clip understands exactly what Trump means when he says big problems. He means there will be blood. That is a threat and that is the promise. And it is not an abstraction. We heard about Rusty Bauer's very real, very disturbing experience. Obviously, we saw how the threats of violence played out in a devastating way on January 6th, when there was real violence. And even now, and this is sort of bubbles underneath the surface of the news, but I will tell you, as someone who watches this, that not a week goes by without a story of some election official or educational civil servant or health administrator getting in the crosshairs of the most vile faction of the MAGA right and finding themselves besieged with harassment and threats. The most recent victim is Boston Children's Hospital. Yes, the Children's Hospital. The top-rated pediatric hospital in the country. The kind of place that treats kids with rare diseases, complex conditions, more than any other facility in the nation. Parents and families travel from all over the world to receive care at Boston Children's. And you can imagine if you're taking your little tiny child who is sick, what a profoundly important place that is to you, and the doctors are. And one of the many services they provide at Boston Children's Hospital is gender-affirming care for transgender youth. And that has recently made Boston Children's, the place that cares for sick kids, a target of malicious misinformation spread online. Some on the far right accuse the hospital of performing hysterectomies on minors, which, of course, is not true, but that didn't matter. No. The lies spread like wildfire as right-wing figures on Fox News and InfoWars, and social media, and the whole MAGA crew whipped up a frenzy claiming the hospital, which cares for sick children, was performing, quote, child mutilation. And as surely as day follows night, Boston Children's began receiving violent threats.
This evening, Boston Children's Hospital under attack. Doctors and staff facing threats of violence after the hospital says it was the focus of a social media campaign about its treatment of transgender youth. Boston Children's says the posts are not accurate. Even so, the hospital says the fallout has been extensive, from threatening emails and phone calls to threats of violence.
And then, the same people who helped whip up the frenzy that led to these threats, including a bomb threat, the same people started claiming it was all hoax. that said the threats were not real, that they were a false flag. There was even one conservative activist portraying himself as an investigative reporter who was on the case, alleging that, well, no one called the police about a bomb threat. But it was not a hoax. It was exactly what it looked like. Yesterday, the FBI announced that they have arrested and charged a Massachusetts woman, a diehard Trump supporter who donated more than $6,000 to his fundraising committees, with making a bomb threat against Boston Children's last month, just one of many in recent weeks.
The hospital has received dozens of hoax threats, including harassing phone calls and emails, individual death threats, and threats of mass casualty attacks.
We arrested Kathleen Levy of Westfield, Massachusetts, for allegedly sending a threatening communication to Boston Children's Hospital and its employees. On August 30th, the hospital received a telephonic bomb threat. The hospital operator answered the call, and the caller said, in part, quote, "There is a bomb on the way to the hospital. You better evacuate everybody, you sickos."
I mean, just take a step back for a second. I don't want to skip past this. This is a place that people come from all over the country with sick kids. Their little kid who's got some rare disorder or genetic complication, and they are terrified and upset, and it's the worst thing that's ever happened to them and their family. And they're in their hospital with these people that are caring for these sick kids. And this place is getting harassed and threatened and fake bomb threats called in. Like, that's a real thing that's happening. It's very real. And that's a children's hospital. Everyone who operates in Republican politics, where they have a special venom for traitors, has to ask themselves, right, do they want to be the next Rusty Bowers or the next Boston Children's Hospital? Brandi Zadrozny is a senior reporter at NBC News, focusing on misinformation and extremism, particularly online. She has reported on the targeting of Boston Children's Hospital. Mark Fulman is the national affairs editor at Mother Jones. His latest piece is how Trump spread incitement and violence throughout the Republican Party. And they both join me now. Brandi, I've sort of followed this story as it's played out. And I find it so both monstrous and just incomprehensible at some level. But at least give us a quick version of how we got to the point that the FBI is announcing the arrest of a woman for calling a bomb threat into a children's hospital.
Sure. Thanks, Chris, for having me. For months now, people mostly on TikTok or mostly on Twitter and other social media platforms have been putting new groups in their crosshairs. There have been, like you said, it's been school teachers, it's been librarians, it's been people who dare think that we should have a diverse workforce or diverse school, or people who put up a Black Lives Matter flag at work. And now it's children's hospitals and doctors who care for trans people and trans youth. That a couple of months ago, these people, one is Libs of TikTok, another is Matt Walsh, you have Chris Rufo, who you just mentioned, they've been villainizing and literally demonizing these doctors who treat these people for months now. And so in that time, you can just see it in their mentions, this sicko language. I've seen it a million times over, because every time they tweet about these doctors, using these doctors' faces sometimes, and all of the comments are like sickos, demonic, satanic, pedophile, groomer. It's just disgusting. And so people called in bomb threats to Boston Children's Hospital, and have called in threats to all kinds of other children's hospitals around the country. It's not just in Boston. And so now one woman is arrested, and wouldn't you know it, people have been really quiet today, all of those people. And the people aren't really, those people that I mentioned aren't talking about children's hospitals today or treating trans kids, young adults or adults. Now they're all talking today about educators, and they focused back on teachers today and claiming that sex education is somehow teaching porn. They'll probably do that till they get in trouble for that, and then it'll be deniability, they'll move on to the next target. But, you know, I think you said it really well. These perceived enemies just keep growing. It's getting incredibly out of hand. Again, teachers, librarians, doctors at children's hospitals, I can't imagine where this goes next.
Yeah, I mean, I want to make a distinction here, right? Because it's like, you know, we have, even though I'm part of the legacy media and this humble little TV show just has millions of people watching it, we take that responsibility seriously. And, you know, there's a question, right, about punching up and punching down. And it's like, you know, public figures, people that are in the public eye, they're, you know, politicians, and you can criticize them. But like, what I've noticed in that part of the world is the targets are getting more and more obscure, right? I mean, Boston Children's Hospital is a big public institution, but it's like a hospital for kids. But it's like, oh, here's some rando education administrator in Idaho who, yeah, like, it's just like, and then all of a sudden, these people who are not public figures, I mean, they're not public figures, right? And we saw this with the election workers and the poll workers, exact same logic of people that are not in the public eye, they're not used to this kind of thing. All of a sudden, from one day to the next, you know, Shea Moss, you wake up and the vigilante digital mob is either in person at your door or electronically. And Mark, you write about how you went to this conference. I found really fascinating about how this has been embedded in kind of conservative politics and your warnings and the warnings about what that could mean. Tell me about that conference.
Yeah, well, I've talked with threat assessment experts for a long time about planned violence in my study of mass shootings for my book Trigger Points, and also with respect to extremism and the growing political violence in the country. And it's really important for people to recognize that this is a method of incitement that's very deliberate. And I think you laid it out really well, you know, the way that we sort of see this plausible deniability around it in the kind of equivocation and backpedaling that we see from Trump and others around him. But they know exactly what they're doing, and they've been doing it for a long time. And what I'm hearing from experts in security and threat assessment is that this is actually getting worse in the year and a half plus now since January 6th, that there's been an emboldening process going on among political leaders. And one of the things that I point out in my piece yesterday is that this is no longer just Trump doing this. There are other Republican leaders who have taken up this tactic and use this kind of ominous language to stir up the extremist base. I think it's a sign of political concern or desperation among them, frankly, but it's very dangerous. I mean, I think we can imagine quite vividly what it's going to lead to, because we've already seen it, not just with January 6th, but if you think back to the Trump presidency, we had two really horrific mass shootings, one in Pittsburgh and one in El Paso, Texas, where the perpetrators were espousing racist claims about an immigrant invasion. I mean, remember how much that rhetoric was being pushed by the Trump White House and Fox News and their allies. And so this tactic, this form of rhetoric has real consequences. And we're seeing it now with Boston Children's and many other examples around the country. They'll target groups or institutions, you know, the Justice Department, the FBI, but also individuals, which is especially alarming and insidious, I think, when you see ordinary citizens, poll workers, teachers, healthcare workers being targeted by this tactic. It's very disturbing.
Yeah, whenever I see someone's, you know, again, it's this strange line that we live in, right? Because it's a world in which like everything's online and everyone's faces and names are online. But when I'm looking through this and some, you know, here's some random doctor, here's some education administrator, here's some healthcare person who's now like, here's their face. You know, when you're seeing that, it's like, it doesn't feel right. The vibes feel bad. And it is what it looks like, you know, at a certain point, whatever plausible deniability people want to raise about it. Brandi Zadrozny and Mark Fulman, thank you so much for your reporting on this and for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Coming up, after Donald Trump's judge stalls the investigation into the classified documents he stole, new reporting, the Trump team has been lying about what Trump took for at least a year. Congressman Eric Swalwell joins me next.
On the MSNBC podcast, How to Win 2024, political experts, former Senator Claire McCaskill and Democratic strategist Jennifer Palmieri examine the campaign strategies unfolding in this all-important election.
The focus is on the voters that are not necessarily in your corner now.
If Democrats are going to win in 2024, we have to be able to explain what is happening at the border and what the solutions are.
Search for How to Win 2024 wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Thursday.
Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
It is a terrible ruling for the rule of law and for Americans' confidence in the integrity of the courts and of the Justice Department.
Well, I'm sure there's some head scratching going on right now at FBI headquarters as to how to proceed here, because it's a nonsensical decision.
There's so many outrageous and stupid, frankly, pieces of this decision. I mean, it's remarkable because you never thought there'd be something worse than her last decision. Mm-hmm. And this actually topped it.
The reality-based legal world continues to pile on Trump-appointed Judge Eileen Cannon for her latest unprecedented ruling, which blocks the FBI from continuing its investigation into Donald Trump's apparent theft of classified documents and appointing a special master to review the thousands of documents seized from Trump's Florida retirement home, including the 100 classified ones, even though there really isn't a question that the classified ones, at the very least, belong to the U.S. government by definition. The Department of Justice is expected to appeal Cannon's ruling, but even now we're learning more about the deception by Trump and his allies. The Washington Post reports, quote, months before National Archives officials retrieved hundreds of classified documents in 15 boxes from former President Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago club, they were told that none of the material was sensitive or classified and that Trump only had 12 boxes of, quote, news clippings. That happened last September. They've been lying about what Trump took for over a year at least. Congressman Eric Swalwell, Democrat of California, served as an impeachment manager in Donald Trump's second impeachment trial for inciting the insurrection. And he joins me now. I mean, Congressman, the latest data point we have about the representations they made to the archives is just another in a long line of, you know, 18 months or however long it took to misrepresentations and outright lies about what they had over and over and over and over again. Are you convinced that the FBI has everything that he might have at this point?
No, Chris. And that's why this ruling has extraordinary consequences on the investigation. And that's why I hope the DOJ appeals it as quickly as possible so they can continue their investigation. Because if you play this out, look, the Department of Justice never wanted to make this public. Donald Trump is the one who made the search public. He's the one who started to challenge parts of the search, and he forced their hand. And typically would not prefer as a prosecutor for this type of information about the investigation to be out there. But what do we know about Donald Trump? We know that when he had $300+ million of military aid, he was willing to leverage that to get dirt on his political opponent with the Ukrainians. So if he has top secret documents, certainly on the other side of his possession of that, we would want to know what foreign nationals has he been in contact with, what foreign nationals around Mar-a-Lago has he been in contact with. And that's all suspended now. And that's the real risk here, is that they can't proceed to run that to ground.
What do you make of the, you know, Lindsey Graham said this a few weeks ago about there's going to be riots in the streets. Donald Trump yesterday saying there's big problems. There seems, you know, this very clear kind of threat, essentially, of what would ensue if the ex-president were to be indicted. What do you make of that?
I see this as a party, a MAGA party, that no longer is confident that they can win elections with votes. And so now they're seeking to enact their political will through violence. They prefer and are more comfortable with violence over voting. And that's what they are telegraphing here as we go into, you know, the midterm elections. And so we have to be very, you know, we have to make sure the FBI continues and the Department of Homeland Security continues to investigate, you know, homegrown domestic extremism groups. I see these threats daily, Chris, and they track with what Donald Trump and Lindsey Graham say, and they track with what Kevin McCarthy and other leaders do not say when they could condemn them, but their silence condones it. And so I am very worried that we could reach another flashpoint like January 6th. But it takes responsible Republicans to unify and speak out against that. Otherwise, everyday MAGA Americans will see it as a permissive lane, a green light, if you will, to commit violence.
There's also more reporting that Mark Meadows is in the middle of all this, and he was one of the people representing that there was nothing there. There's also been news that he was subpoenaed by that grand jury out of Washington, D.C. Meadows remains sort of a strange figure, a kind of black hole in the center of this whole thing. Do you have a theory of what the deal is with Mark Meadows, who you served with in the U.S. Congress?
I remember him as being somebody who wanted to be liked by everybody. So it doesn't surprise me that he wants to please Donald Trump, but also wants to be, wants to honor the subpoena and turn over text messages and make sure that, as far as in the mainstream media, he's still regarded with a good reputation. And so because he has no core set of values, he kind of finds himself, stretched in so many different ways. But he is a hub, so to speak, in that he interacted with Donald Trump. He interacted with Rudy Giuliani and many of, the outside groups. And so he knows a lot about what happened. And so if we can get all of these text messages from him, and if the Department of Justice can, whether it's the committee or the DOJ, we're certainly going to learn a lot about what the president did or did not do on that day.
That's actually quite clarifying, that theory. I mean, someone who doesn't want to have to choose in a moment of choosing, that makes a lot of his behavior make a lot more sense, Congressman.
I saw that all too often. We got elected at the same time, and yeah, that was 10 years of observation.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Congressman. Still ahead, even more Republican candidates try and rid themselves of the Trump stain, but is pretending to be a moderate for the next 7 weeks enough to fool the voters? Next.
Hey, everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? We're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow. Hey, everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
So earlier this week, New Hampshire, Delaware, and Rhode Island all had their primary elections, the last primaries of the season, which means the candidates who won on Tuesday night have the least amount of time to gracefully transition from primary mode to general election mode. And because of that, we are seeing candidates who campaigned as MAGA Republicans try and do an immediate about-face. Like, for instance, Caroline Leavitt. She's a young New Hampshire Republican candidate for the House, who won her primary in a state that President Joe Biden carried by over 7 points in 2020. She's running in a kind of swingy district. And right after her win, notice the change in the Twitter bio. She scrubbed her Twitter bio, removing any mention of her work for House Republican Conference Chair Elise Stefanik or ex-President Donald Trump, just totally gone. Or take the guy who won the New Hampshire Republican primary for Senate, Don Bolduc. He will face off against sitting Democratic Senator Maggie Hassan. Now, Bolduc is one of over 120 former top military officials who signed this big letter spreading the big lie that the 2020 election was rigged. And in 2021, he told The New Yorker he would overturn the election results in 2024 if he deems them fraudulent. The night he won the primary, he came out holding a shield with the letter V studded with arrows. But then yesterday, he just amazingly seemed to change his mind about whether the 2020 election was stolen.
One of the things that Maggie Hassan, the Senate incumbent, will say is that you are an election denier, that you deny that President Biden won the 2020 election. And there's this from August 14th when you had a debate. Watch here.
I signed a letter with 120 other generals and admirals saying that Trump won the election, and damn it, I stand by my election.
Do you stand by that today?
So, we we live and learn, right? And I've done a lot of research on this, and I've spent the past couple of weeks talking to Granite Staters all over the state from every party. And I have come to the conclusion, and I want to be definitive on this, the election was not stolen.
Well, what do you know? Welcome to the party. Election denier? Me? Well, Don Bolduc? Oh. Here's the thing. All these people understand that Donald Trump and pro-coup talk can help win a primary with the base, but not that popular at large, actually. And for all kinds of reasons, including history, economic conditions, high inflation, Republicans in the upcoming midterm election should be poised for like a 2010-style sweep. Right now, it's not looking like that. As we mentioned off the top, new polling from New York Times and Siena College shows that despite low approval ratings for President Biden, currently at 42%, and Republican advantages on a priority of issues like the economy, where they lead by 14 points, when it comes to generally who people are going to vote for, Democrats have a narrow 2-point advantage. And historically, even that slim lead is an anomaly. We're going to talk about what's up there, and what's going on next. Despite a slew of factors that would traditionally give Republicans an advantage in the midterm elections this fall, new polling shows Democrats are still surprisingly competitive. At least that's not just this poll. A whole bunch of polls have shown that. Part of that has to do with where Democrats are on social issues. Data from a New York Times Siena College poll finds that, quote, Democrats held an overwhelming 73-18% lead among voters who said societal issues like abortion or threats to democracy would be most important in their vote this November, rather than economic issues like jobs and the cost of living. That same poll shows that voters use the word extreme to describe Republicans more than Democrats by a 6-point margin. When it comes to the Supreme Court's decision to end the constitutional right to an abortion, 10% of voters somewhat oppose it, and 52% strongly oppose it. Very lopsided feelings on that issue. All this makes for a midterm election that might not look like any we've seen before. Molly Murphy is a Democratic pollster and campaign strategist. She's president of the public opinion research and consulting firm Impact Research, and she joins me now. Molly, the New York Times poll carries some weight with me because they've been very reliable. They do like big samples. And I was really struck by this basic contradiction, which tracks with what we cover here, right? Like, it should be a very favorable environment for Republicans. It's not. And here are the reasons why. What do you think about it?
Well, I think that absolutely the economy is important to voters. All the polling data we're seeing suggests that. But it also suggests that abortion is a number two issue for voters. And Democrats are pressing advantages on abortion, but they're also not ceding ground on the economy. And so it's creating a very competitive environment. Went to your point, normally you would not expect Democrats to be this competitive.
Yeah, on the economy, I do wonder how much the decline of gas prices, you know, helps. I mean, there's all sorts of political science literature that says it's one of the key variables in presidential approval. When gas prices go up, presidential approval goes down, vice versa. How central do you think that is to just this sort of thermometer feeling people have about the economy?
It absolutely plays a day-to-day role. I was just in focus groups in a swing state last week, and when you asked people how they were feeling about the economy, they generally weren't feeling good about the economy overall, but caveated that, well, I have to say, I've noticed gas prices are going down. That is a really dominant indicator for voters in their day-to-day lives about how things are going, and they're starting to see that decline.
And when they say they haven't felt good about the economy, that's inflation specifically, they tell you?
Inflation. They talk about how much they're paying for groceries in particular and for a long time gas.
There's this thing that happens in campaigns, which is there's a kind of meta campaign over what will be the issues that define a campaign, right? So if you know that you have a 30-point advantage on abortion or a 30-point advantage on, you know, democracy, it's like you're the, as a candidate, you want to talk about that. And if you're the other one, you want to talk about the stuff that you might have an advantage on, say, inflation, or as we're seeing with this, you know, stunt over the last 48 hours, immigration, right, where Republicans think they have an advantage there. How much can candidates affect what the attentional focus of a race is, or is that outside their control?
You know, the national environment is going to play a role in any campaign, and there's no two ways about that. But I do think that you've got candidates out there who are driving what they have done on the economy. They are not taking the sort of national headwinds on the economy lying down, and they are out there selling what they've done on the economy, whether it is bringing semiconductor chip plants and manufacturing back to the United States, passing prescription drug negotiation reform, things like that, that basically don't take this lying down and paint a picture of themselves as a champion on the economy, while also recognizing that, to your point, there's an enormous issue on voters' minds right now where Democrats have 20, 30, 40 point advantages, depending on the state. And that's the issue of abortion. And so they're able to paint a meaningful contrast with Republicans who basically have gone silent on abortion. They're not fighting the attacks that they are going to ban it. Lindsey Graham is out there going one step further and promising that he will. And then you've got Democrats out there who are absolutely not taking this economic assertion that a bad economy means Democrats are failing lying down.
Yeah, that's a great point, right? So you've got to narrow that gap in the economy. And the economy is not something you can just be like, well, I'm just not going to talk about. Like, it's the central reality for people. And it's interesting that you noted that, too. I do think, you know, we've seen the approval ratings come up for the president after the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act. And when you mentioned, you know, onshoring manufacturing or bring prescription drugs down, that second one being in the IRA, having a concrete thing to go tell voters, I mean, how much does that matter, right? When you're trying to sort of fight to a draw on that economic question, to say, look, we just did this thing. Here's what I stand for.
It's critical. I mean, voters are completely disillusioned with Washington, with politics, and they're disillusioned with both parties. They don't think either side gets anything done. They don't really want to pay attention to the day-to-day sort of circus that they're seeing in Washington. And so when you are a candidate running in a race, you have to imagine that voters will not hear about your accomplishments on their own. And if they don't hear about it, they will just assume that you've done nothing. And so being able to go out there and point to things, and that doesn't mean saying, look, I did the Inflation Reduction Act and calling these things out by their bills' names and things like that. Obviously, you know, voters don't need to know the names of the bills you've passed. They need to know the ways in which you have fought for issues that matter to them, like bringing jobs back to the United States, you know, fighting, you know, to reduce the, you know, costs of everyday goods, prescription drug prices. And Democrats right now, at this point in the cycle, are the only party out there who have accomplishments to tout on that front.
Yeah, it's a really good point. This is that was really interesting, Molly. Molly Murphy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. More than 30 years ago, a black teenager was shot and killed by a white police officer. It's a story that may sound familiar because it's been repeated so many times. And the aftermath stoked these very intense racial tensions in the New Jersey suburb where it happened. Now, that suburb has its own particular story. And the incredible lasting legacy of that violence is the subject of our next conversation. On April 10th, 1990, Philip Pennell, a 16-year-old black teenager, was shot and killed by a white police officer in the town of Teaneck, New Jersey. Pennell and his friends were crossing through an elementary school parking lot when they were approached by a police vehicle. According to witnesses, officers had their guns drawn as they opened their doors and ordered the boys up against the wall of the school. Pennell ran, and he was fatally shot in the back by police. Protests and outrage followed, and the suburban New Jersey town that had once been thought of as a kind of racial utopia in America became defined by racial tension and outrage in the wake of the police shooting of Philip Pennell. Now, a new four-part series from MSNBC Films called Model America explores Pennell's death, the truth about Teaneck's supposedly integrated community, and echoes from a generation ago that feel eerily present today.
There was no reason for that cop to shoot him in his back.
Just his back. He had a gun. He had a gun. He had a gun. He had a gun.
And he was going to shoot me. That's the truth.
My 16-year-old brother was slain 30 years ago in Teaneck, New Jersey.
My shooting will never go away. It's with me every day of my life.
That was my child. We endured this pain for 30 years. And we're back here again.
Hey. Tiger Williams is the executive producer of Model America. The four-part series premieres Sunday at 10 p.m. right here on MSNBC. Mr. Williams, it's great to have you on the program. Congrats on a great piece of work. I think if you could talk a little bit to start out about Teaneck, New Jersey as a place and what makes it different in really key ways than some of the other bedroom communities in big metro areas that gave Teaneck this very specific reputation for many years before the shooting.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having me. Teaneck was unique in the sense that it was one of the first communities to voluntarily desegregate schools. And just after World War II, it got the reputation of being a model community, of being a model America. That's how it was marketed. That's why people moved there. It was very diverse socially, economically, culturally, racially. And, I think that's unique in a lot of places. And so this incident sort of uncovered things that hadn't been dealt with, for the residents.
What does happen in the aftermath of Pennell shooting?
Well, the city kind of comes to a reckoning. People thought things were fine. They thought everything was going well. Everyone was getting along. And we discover that people weren't feeling like everything was going along. People weren't having those conversations. There were tensions. There had been tensions between the police and young Black men in the community that people weren't talking about. And so this really kind of opened the town's eyes, the amount of rage, frustration, the shock that it could happen there. I think that was the biggest thing. No one ever thought it could happen there in Teaneck.
I want to play just a little bit of some more footage because it's compelling stuff about sort of how the community reacts when word comes around that this 16-year-old boy has been shot by police. Take a listen.
I got a call from a liquor store owner in Teaneck who was a friend of mine. And he just called me up kind of screaming.
And they said there was a shooting.
Teaneck police just shot somebody. They shot a young kid. They shot a Black kid.
In Teaneck, a white cop shot a Black kid? I can't believe it. That's not supposed to happen.
It's striking how contemporary so much of this story feels, even though it's 32 years ago, both in the details of what happened, in the aftermath that happened, some of the conversations that happened. How do you see the kind of line between then and now?
I mean, that's the thing that drew me to the story and why we wanted to make it. It's because it was 30 years ago and things like this continue to happen. They've happened since. They probably happened before. It's a tragedy. It's a true tragedy. And I think the summer of 2020 reminded us of that. And so really, this project is really a call for a conversation, a dialogue, really. And unless we have these dialogues, things like this will continue to bubble up and shock us and surprise us.
There's obviously, there were a lot of Black Lives Matter protests in the summer of 2020 in the town of Teaneck. There's footage of that. Were there lessons learned? Were there improvements made? Was there something that came out of the aftermath of this that looked like progress? Or did it sort of fade into the background and until the next incident?
I think it kind of lives with the residents, but I don't know if anything was actively done about it. It lives with the residents. People have different opinions about what happened. Some people hold to the lines that they held in 1990. Some people have changed sides. But it is still a divisive issue in the community. People are still surprised that it could happen in a place like Teaneck. And so I think in making this documentary, it sort of allowed several people in the town to have this conversation.
Yeah. Tiger Williams, thank you so much for making time with us. It's called Model America from MSNBC Films. It premieres Sunday night at 10 p.m. Eastern right here on MSNBC. It is also streaming now on Peacock. You can check it out if you have Peacock.
That does it for All In. You can catch us every weeknight at 8 o'clock on MSNBC. Don't forget to like us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/allinwithchris.
When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.